You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the Syria peace talks. Does Iran's first appearance at the table raise the chances of agreement from unlikely to merely implausible, or reduce them all the way to impossible? My guests Ramita Navai and Martin Plaut will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Turkey's unrelentingly tedious crackdown on the press. Will the result of this weekend's election relieve it or accelerate it? The last British resident held in Guantanamo Bay comes home. What explanation and or compensation is now owed to Shaka Amer? And we'll see if we can figure out why the British police want to know which Monocle 24 programmes you've been listening to. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ramita Navai, journalist and author, most recently of City of Lies, and Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome both. We will start in Vienna, where not quite everybody but Syria is meeting to discuss the war in Syria. The talks will have necessitated some exceedingly tactful arrangement of the seating. The guest list includes representatives of many countries whose present relationships with each other range from ossified resentment to barely disguised war. So what are the chances of getting the United States, Russia, Turkey, Qatar, Egypt, Iraq, Saudi Arabia and Iran to agree on the soup, never mind a peace agreement? Ramita, first of all, the latest we have is John Kerry saying that US, Russia and Iran have agreed to disagree on the immediate future of Bashar al-Assad. What does that actually mean?
It means that we're in for tedious, protracted negotiations that will probably last for a very long time, think nuclear negotiations. But I don't think that it's all negative. I think what we saw today is that there's some progress made, even though it's kind of baby steps, but Iran and the US are making concessions, and they really are. So not so long ago, the US was saying, even if it's denying it now, the US, they really were saying, absolutely, Assad must go. And Iran was saying, absolutely, Assad must stay. All of a sudden, Iran today, the deputy foreign minister, has said, well, actually, we're prepared to see the end of Assad. We're not insisting that Assad will stay. And Iran has now offered this six-month transitionary period followed by elections. So, well, let's see. It's the beginning.
It does. Well, the idea of a transition period in Syria followed by elections does seem to be the very definition of easier said than done from where we are now. Martin, it has the absence of any actual Syrians from these discussions has been much discussed. Is that actually a bad thing? Does it actually make sense for the rest of the world, if it can, to get together and present to all of Syria's querulous factions at once basically a statement saying this is what's going to happen?
Well, I can't imagine how one could do it any other way, since after all, there are so many factions, and who would you have in the room? I mean, if it's difficult to have even the external actors in the room and agreeing, as you say, on the price of the soup, was it the quality of the soup? I don't know.
There's room for argument on both fronts, I would think.
How on earth would you get all the Syrians around the table? So I think it was vital that it has to be done this way. But in a sense, you know, the big problem for both sides was, hauling their proxies in on the deal. I mean, John Kerry had to go to Saudi Arabia in order to try and haul the Saudis in and get them to accept the idea that this might take place. Assad was hauled off to Moscow by Putin in order to sort of put him in his place. So, you know, everybody had to be dragged along screaming to come to these talks.
Ramita, the exciting new development with these ones, of course, has been the fact that Iran, who are clearly a participant in the war in Syria, were actually invited to the table. I was struck myself, and I know you were as well, by the pre-match trash talking between themselves and the Saudis. The Iran's chief of staff, Major General Hassan Firouzabadi, called the Saudis arrogant, illegitimate, and for good measure, war criminals.
Echoing what many Iranians in Iran, I think, would say about Arabs in general. Iranians being able to be quite racist at times.
And at least one Gulf diplomat responded similarly unpleasantly towards the Iranians.
This is one of my favourite quotes of the whole week. He said, They're inviting the vultures to the banquet table and they expect them to wear napkins and be nice to the waiters.
It's an enticing image, isn't it? But how weird is it now, or how, I guess, rebalancing of relationships has Syria been, that now the United States and Iran appear to be getting on better with each other than either of them do with the Saudis?
Well, I think what's happening is extraordinary. So Iran is coming in from the cold. And this, you know, not very long ago, Iran was not invited to the table. This would not have been happening, this meeting. So it shows you just how much things have changed. I think also all, you know, as we were saying, the puppet masters are at the table, but the puppets aren't at the table. So this is really where the real decisions and the real power lies. And I also think the individual relationships between the countries is interesting, timing-wise. So this comes, just a month after Russia started its bombing campaign, which tipped for the first time things in Assad's favour, right? So there's a real need now to bring Iran and Syria into the mix. Also, we're talking about Russia. This is where it gets very interesting. So some really well-placed Russian sources, it was reported in Der Spiegel, were saying that that Assad actually was pleading with the Russians to enter Russia and help because he wanted to counterbalance Iran's power, because Assad is now really scared of what Iran can do. And he's beginning to realize that he's dispensable to the Iranians.
Martin, on that subject of the Russian intervention having tipped the balance militarily, possibly, as far as these things are possible to tell, in Assad's favour, when you get, as Ramita's pointed out, when you get parties that were previously dead set against Assad staying longer than was absolutely necessary, now saying that they're open to the idea of some sort of transition, is what we're seeing here people coming uneasily around to the idea that the least worst available option is just to end this war as fast as possible, and that might mean helping Assad to win it?
I can't imagine that there are many people who want Assad actually to win. I think that is going further than I can't imagine anybody would want that, except perhaps the Russians. Maybe the Russians see, you know, since he is their man, they would like him to win. But, I mean, you now have the Americans being prepared to put 50 special forces into the region. How is that going to tip the balance? And, you know, I mean, if some of us sadly have longer memories than certainly probably both of you, I do, which is that, you know, I remember this is the way it began in Vietnam. A few special advisors, just a few troops on the ground, just a bit of training. Where does it end up? And the extraordinary thing is that you now have President Obama, who swore that he was going to be the man who pulled the troops back, no involvement in extraneous military adventures, now still having his troops in Afghanistan. There's still going to be 5,000 there when he goes, involved in a spat with the Chinese, and now putting troops on the ground in the Middle East. Whoa, this is a big change.
Just a final thought on this one before we move on, Ramita. To what extent do you think... This is just it's a thing that occurs to me from time to time when you watch sort of powers from outside the Middle East, especially in this case, the United States and Russia, trying to make sense of events within the Middle East. To what extent are they underestimating religion? To what extent is this basically a sectarian punch-up?
I think it's, for Iran, it's as much geopolitical as it is about religion. You're right, you know, the reason Syria is so geopolitically important to Iran is because of this so-called Shia crescent, which stretches through southern Iraq to Syria to Lebanon. And another reason Syria is of vital importance, again, comes down to religion in broader terms. But it's because, you know, it's very unlikely that a Western-backed regime or a Sunni leader in Syria would allow Iran to transport its weapons to Hezbollah. So Syria is a corridor for Iranian weapons to Hezbollah, and that's another reason why Iran is so keen on having a finger in the pie, and it will. And look what happened to Iraq. I think if we want to see what could possibly happen with a transition, with Assad stepping down, it's what happened with Maliki, you know, on a different scale. But the Iranians, there was no way the Iranians weren't going to be involved with Maliki stepping down and with approving a new leader.
And, of course, this is all before we even talk about Yemen, which comes into the mix as well.
Indeed. So that, I suspect, is a whole other programme. We will move along now. The talks in Vienna, as we've been discussing, are that somewhat unwieldy mix of Western democracies and Middle Eastern tyrannies. And one participant has, in recent years especially, appeared to have increasing difficulty deciding which of these it wants to be. Turkey, which is holding elections this weekend, is also conducting a crackdown on the press and free speech in general, uncompromising even by Turkey's standards. Among the victims have been a TV station forced off air by a police raid, and two children arrested for tearing a poster of the country's clearly somewhat sensitive president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Martin, it's very hard to tell reading various reports of this sort coming out of Turkey, and there's never a shortage of them, whether this is all part of some actual coherent plan or whether it is just in the way that overly powerful institutions of all sorts eventually do. They just end up lumbering around looking for excuses to exert it.
Oh, I think it's a very clearly part of a plan. The plan is to win the election. And what do you need to do? This is just getting rid of, or at least silencing, some of the more unpleasant press. And he's been on shouting at editors, threatening them with arrest. I mean, this is just the most extreme example of this. But Erdogan's clearly prepared to do almost anything to hang on to power, and is furious that the Kurdish party managed to get even a toehold in parliament. So, here, this is just, an extension of other means. This is war by extension through other means, in a sense. I don't think it's very surprising. And I'm very sorry for my colleagues in the journalistic community, but you've got to be a brave person to be a journalist in Turkey.
Well, indeed. So Turkey, astonishingly, for a country which officially still entertains ambitions of joining the EU, presently rates 149 out of the 180 countries in the World Press Freedom Index, which puts it behind Ethiopia and Afghanistan, and one rung above the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ramita, why does President Erdogan not appear remotely embarrassed by that?
Good question, because he bloody well should, shouldn't he?
He really
Although,
should.
Do you know what? I think what's really kind of quite juicy and interesting for me with the latest rounds, the latest crackdown, is that, yes, it's some overall plan, and he's obviously turning into some crazed authoritarian dictator. However, I think the really juicy bit is that really there's a grudge behind the latest closure of the TV station. So the media company that owns the TV station is affiliated to this Islamic preacher. The Islamic preacher falls out with Erdogan and the crackdown begins. So that's also, that tells you a lot about Turkish politics as well. Kind of personal grudges rule.
It is astonishing how thin-skinned the incredibly powerful can be, isn't it?
Well, they don't like leaving anything to chance. You either rig the constitution or you rig the counting. And you remember the famous phrase that Stalin put out, it's not he who votes that changes anything, it's he who counts the vote that changes things. So, he's just taking the necessary steps in order to get there. And, coming from an African background as I do, we've seen this everywhere. And, one of the laws that is currently in place in Turkey, which is, I suppose, has to do with these two children that have been arrested, is this idea that you may not insult the president. In many, many African countries, for example, Zimbabwe, you have exactly the same kind of rules, and they are enforced for exactly the same reasons, because the big man has to preserve his huge persona, and his persona is certainly bigger than anything else one could possibly imagine in the country.
There have also long been laws in Turkey against insulting or defaming the memory of the founder of the Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who I rather suspect would increasingly struggle to recognise Turkey, at least under Erdogan. On the subject of the EU, which we mentioned earlier, which Turkey still, in theory, wants to join, should the EU be doing more, Ramita, to sort of remind Turkey that if it does want to join at some point, it does have to stop behaving like this?
Of course it should. However, at the moment, Turkey's got some good leverage against the EU because of the refugee crisis. So we saw Merkel kind of desperately flying over, pleading with Erdogan to help with the refugee crisis. And one of the carrots that she was dangling was that the EU will restart negotiations, restart discussions about Turkey joining the EU. So I think the EU should be doing something, but at the moment it really is in no position to say anything. And Erdogan loves this position he's in. He's completely empowered, and I think it looked very good for him pre-election.
Is it still clear to us, though, and I'll ask you this, Martin, how keen, the AKP in general and Erdogan in particular really actually are on the whole secular liberal democracy thing?
I don't think they're particularly keen on it. But, I mean, as you say, it is part of the Ataturk tradition. They can't possibly, move away from that since it's the beginning of the legitimacy of the entire country. So they have to nominally be in favour of it. But, you know, they are the countryside. They are the conservative forces in society. It's not surprising they're taking this position. Of course, they don't represent modern Turkey. But modern Turkey is unfortunately in a minority in this particular bust-up. And it's just sad that they are that's the way it is. But as you say, I mean, the refugee situation, I mean, all Turkey has to do, in a sense, is make it even easier for refugees to come across the borders into Europe, make it even less pleasant for refugees to remain inside its own territory, and Europe is going to be in a flat spin. So what can they possibly do?
The thing that always strikes me about crackdowns of this sort by tyrannies, though, especially now, is how incredibly dunderheaded it is from their own point of view, because Turkey has also extended this in recent months to foreign journalists. They arrested a Dutch reporter, Frederik Geerdink. They arrested and deported two journalists from Vice, and their fixer, Mohamed Rasul, is still in custody. All of which, of course, just goes to attract more attention to what they're doing than just letting the reporters quietly file their stories and go home would, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? I think for the first time it's seeming to backfire. So it appears that conservative, Quran-reading Turks, who have been very supportive of Erdogan, for the first time, it appears that they are not so supportive. They've been really angered by the storming of this TV company that happened a couple of days ago. You know, and they are the ones who are usually silent, who have been out protesting. And this is where it's going to get really interesting for the elections. And this is possibly where the HDP can attract voters like these conservative Turks who previously had voted for Erdogan.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, Ramita Navai and Martin Plaut. Coming up next, the last British resident inmate of Guantanamo Bay comes home and the reasons why GCHQ might want to know which trampolining cat video you've been watching.
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ramita Navai and Martin Plaut. It's a few weeks now, short of 14 years, since Shaka Ameh, a Saudi citizen resident in the UK, was captured in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, by the Northern Alliance and turned over to US forces. By February 2002, he was interned in America's Caribbean gulag at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He arrived back in the UK earlier this afternoon on a private jet chartered by the British government. He has never been charged, and British officials have confirmed confirmed that there are no plans to detain, to detain him any further. Begging the question, Martin, why hang on to the guy for 14 years if we've got nothing on him?
It's an excellent question to which there is absolutely no answer. I mean, the extraordinary thing was that six times he was actually cleared of having been involved in anything. Now, I have no idea, literally no idea, why they held on to him or whether the allegations against him, which are tremendously serious and have been made in public repeatedly, are true. So it's a mystery within an enigma.
Which we will doubtless learn more about in coming weeks. Ramita, President Barack Obama, when he was running for election, one of his signature promises was that he would close Guantanamo Bay. There are still 112 people there. Why has he not managed it?
He either doesn't have the political power or he doesn't have the will. I mean, certainly the question is what's going to happen to the prisoners if he closes it down? You know, there are many US politicians who are saying, we do not want these terrorists in our American jails. You know, what do we do with them? You can't send some of the prisoners back to their own countries. But to change points, I do think I do have an answer for why he has been there without charge and held for so long, even though the Brits have been lobbying for his return officially since 2010. And I think that's because he knows too much. So what he will bring back here will be his experience of Guantanamo, and that is of torture, and that is also of MI6 complicity. So we already know that he's been tortured at Bagram with CIA and MI6 officials. So British watching him, not doing anything, while he had his head repeatedly knocked against a wall 300 times.
So you think this might be one of those things where people, and it's not an uncommon human reaction to a gatheringly difficult situation that basically everyone's just been desperately ignoring it in the hope that it will somehow go away.
Yeah. And he's, you know, he's a really, by all accounts, he's a really smart, eloquent man. And people are scared of what he knows and how he's going to talk about it and the experience that he brings back.
Martin, how much public sympathy do you think he can count on upon his return and upon him starting to speak? And let's proceed, as I suppose we should, on the assumption that he is entirely innocent. He has not been charged nor convicted. Assuming that is in fact the case, and that he was in Afghanistan merely working as an aid worker, and people were in 2001, that's not necessarily implausible. How sympathetic are the British public likely to be?
I think only moderately sympathetic. After all, he doesn't look like a Brit, he doesn't feel like a Brit. They're not so sure what a Brit is.
Well, he is in fact a Saudi citizen, but he's British resident because he's married to a British citizen.
Indeed. So I don't think there's a huge amount of sympathy for him, but there have been enormously high profile campaigns on his behalf. The Prime Minister has intervened. David Davis, who is a Conservative Member of Parliament, but has an extremely good record on human rights issues, has intervened on his behalf. There's been an all-party campaign, try and get him freed. And, you know, the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, has repeatedly called for his freeing. And as you say, there is not a single shred of evidence against him. But there are these things that hang over him. And I think that that is the problem. And there are people who have been saying, even today, that there is evidence that he was involved in Tora Bora, that he was a member of Al-Qaeda, that there are all sorts of allegations against him. And these, you know, do pollute the air. And, you know, as long as they've been allowed to be out there, nobody's been able to find out whether they're true or not, then the amount of sympathy for this man would necessarily be limited.
What do you think, Ramita? Do you think he will get possibly a less generous hearing than he might if his name was Bill Smith and he didn't have a beard?
Possibly, but I like to think people will be sympathetic, and maybe that's me, you know, maybe that's wishful thinking and my belief in the humanity of our, you know, the people of our country. You know, his response so far has been really human. He said, I need to come back and I need to find myself. I need to understand who the real me is, because for so long I've been called Prisoner 239. So he said through friends that he doesn't even know if his children are going to call him daddy, you know, when people call his name, if he'll even be able to respond. You know, these are really human reactions. Also, the fact that he's never seen his 14-year-old son. And I think, you know, when you watching the news reports today, watching the vox pops, I think that really has resonated with a lot of people. I think there will be sympathy for him.
Okay. Well, finally tonight, and given that so much online discourse consists of people attempting to tell the world far more about themselves than any sane person could possibly wish to know, efforts by the authorities to access still further personal data may seem somewhat redundant. Nevertheless, the British government intends to make them. Its new surveillance bill will, among other powers, permit police to access the web browsing histories of UK citizens. Martin, is this really actually going to be useful to them?
I think it's vital to them. I mean, the authorities need some kind of cover for what they are doing. Now, I mean, ever since the Victorian era, the cables came through London, physical cables came through London, and it was said that the British, before the First World War, could read three quarters of all telex material in the world and continued to read German unencrypted cables even during the First World War. Britain has been at the heart of ensuring that they knew what the hell you were thinking for a very, very long time.
This isn't just communications, though. This is what people are reading. How is this different from the cops turning up on the doorstep and asking for a look at your bookshelves?
Because they look at your bookshelves without you even knowing about it, and they collect the data and analyse the data and see who you've been speaking to. It's not really that they want to know specifically what you're saying, certainly not in the first instance. They want to make the connections. Who are you looking at? What are you looking at? Where are you putting your information, and what are you searching for? And all of this tells the spies a great deal. They produce these huge and very complex patterns, which they then analyze and then point to certain things happening and relationships between people across the globe. And they want this to be done without a judge. That is the key point in all of this.
But this is also my key point, and at the risk of sounding like a head-banging libertarian crank, Ramita, I will ask...
I'll do that for you.
I will ask the leading question. Until or unless anybody's got a reasonable suspicion that I'm actually breaking the law, how is what I'm looking at on the internet any of anyone's damn business?
It's not. And I think it's exactly as Martin was saying and what you're about to bring up. It needs judicial oversight. It's absolutely absurd that there will be no judicial oversight. And that's the only way that you can do this. Otherwise, this is the kind of thing that dictators do. And Theresa May saying, you know, if you have nothing to hide, then you know, you shouldn't be hiding from us. That is dictator
exactly
talk.
Exactly the point Mr. Putin always makes.
Well, exactly.
Whenever people raise that one, the whole kind of nothing to hide, nothing to fear thing, I do always ask them if I could have a look through their bank statements and medical histories. No one's ever said yes yet.
It's the one
enough
thing that all Brits hate, the idea that you might know what they earn.
It is extraordinary, though, Martin. The proposed bill, as I understand it, will allow police to seize the details of websites, access specific web addresses visited, but they're saying that they will require, this is the bit we're supposed to feel good about, they will require judicial approval to access the content of the websites. Now, that's a pretty fatuous distinction, isn't it?
Indeed, and that's why, because it's not important. What they want to know are the patterns. They don't really care so much about what you're actually saying, because they could probably guess what it is if they can work out the patterns. But the extraordinary thing about this is that they would not only want to do it in this country, they would wish to use these laws to force organizations like Facebook and Google, which are actually based in the United States, to come into this system as well. And that is why it is so toxic. The other thing about it, of course, is that, you know, that in a sense, I thought many of these things were already going on. Perhaps they were, but we just didn't know about it. And Mr. Snowden was saying, and apparently, that they can even turn on your mobile phone, even if it was switched off, and listen to the damn thing. Now, I don't know if that's true. How on earth would I know?
I have but days when I can't switch on my mobile phone. Ramit, a final thought on this, and a brief one, unfortunately. Why do people seem like, and I mean general public reaction, seems so sanguine about this? There's not the outrage that there would be if cops started kicking in people's doors and writing down the names of, you know, their favourite books.
Well, I think the government's been very clever in trying to persuade people by bandying around words like paedophile and terrorist, their favourite words. But certainly not as a member of the public, but as a journalist, I think this could be an absolute catastrophe, because this means that they would have a way of getting to our sources, and there would be the end of democracy.
And they would look at the what was said between a somebody who was charged with a crime and a lawyer. Very, very worrying.
Yeah. But at least we can be completely confident that the data would never, ever leak. Ramita Navai and Martin Plaut, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Inez Fresine. Our studio manager was Chris Grimes. For the next half hour, Chris Chilvers is keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows him with The Menu at 1900. I'm back with Emma Nelson for The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend.